The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, everybody. It's Henry Gilbert, recorded December 17th, 2019. And that is a very special day because it's the 30th anniversary of the premiere of The Simpsons Christmas Special, aka Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. This is quite an important day in Simpsons history. So, of course, we're going to do some cool stuff with it. You're going to see a really cool podcast go up tonight on the Patreon feed and then a week later on the free feed, and a really cool poll that's going to be open to the public that I want all you guys to vote in. But first, we're starting out with a blast from our past, a podcast recorded a couple years ago with Mimi Pond, the writer of this episode. She is a very accomplished comic artist and television writer who is the credited writer of this major episode of television history. But it's not all smiles and sunshine with this story, unfortunately. But I think it's important to hear Mimi's side of the story too when we're celebrating this amazing anniversary of The Simpsons. So, previously only available to our Patreon supporters, we're opening it up to you guys on the free and Patreon feed again today, so you can hear it and hear the story in her own words. And of course, subscribe at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons if you want to hear another really cool anniversary podcast going live very soon, a week ahead of time, and ad free there. But for now, let's go back in time a couple years to our interview with Mimi Pond.
The fourth grade will now favor us with a melody medley of holiday favorites.
Dashing through the snow in a one horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Ha ha ha, bells on bobtail ring, making
spirits glow. Isn't Bart sweet, Homer? He sings like an angel.
Oh, jingle bells, Batman smells, Robin lays an egg. The Batmobile broke its wheel, the Joker got a
Ahoy, hoy, everyone. Bob Mackie wasn't feeling too well, so it's just me for this exclusive interview, but it's a very important one, and we certainly couldn't miss this date. In case you don't know, this week marks 28 years since the premiere of The Simpsons with the Christmas special, also known as Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. Now, we've talked a ton about the history of the show and how there was production problems, all that stuff, and the Christmas special was the first one to air in December of 1989. But one thing we really didn't talk about when we did that episode way back when we started talking Simpsons, and one area that isn't explored enough, is the writer of the episode, Mimi Pond. Was not any commentaries. She hasn't been involved in many stories about the Simpsons history. And she's a figure in Simpsons history that I didn't really know a ton about either until some recent interviews this year that were eye-opening, to say the least. If you've been listening to our Talk to the Audience podcast, where we engage in the community, Bob and I definitely talked about the information she had shared in other interviews that she wasn't on staff because Sam Simon didn't didn't want any women on staff at the time. He was executive producer of the show in the early years. And that's some tough medicine to swallow. But I think it's something that, as fans of the show, you have to recognize as part of its history. And we were fortunate enough to reach out to Mimi for a podcast interview on this very subject and her history with The Simpsons, as well as a ton of her work in the world of comics, other television shows, including Pee-wee's Playhouse, and what she's been up to now. Like, Mimi Pond has had an amazing career, and one that I think is certainly worth exploring, even if she had nothing to do with The Simpsons. But her story of working on that first episode of The Simpsons is certainly eye-opening, and one that a lot of fans haven't heard, but I really think would benefit from hearing. So I was able to interview for a good 30 minutes about her career, including her work on this episode. And, you know, I think you folks will really enjoy it. She is a very funny woman. And I'll just say up front, if you are looking to read more work by her, I would first suggest reading her two recent autobiographical comic memoirs, I guess you'd put it, Over Easy and The Customer Is Always Wrong. I've been pouring through both of them. They're really great. It's kind of her life story, and it's very engaging, to say the least. But so, without further ado, let me get into my interview with a very important Mimi Pond on this big anniversary of her episode of The Simpsons. Well, okay, so here I am with the Mimi Pond, the comic artist and writer of the first ever aired episode of The Simpsons. How's it going, Mimi?
It's going good. How about you?
Oh, it's all right. You know, I have a giant IKEA couch I got to put together, but other than that, I'm doing okay.
By yourself, or do you have someone to do it with?
My boyfriend's going to help me, but he's busy. It's tough. It's tough to find the time.
It's a kind of a relationship maker or breaker, mm-hmm. I've found. Honestly, I was amazed that my husband and I turn out to be really good at doing that together. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be a deal breaker, but I kind of cede to the fact that he has a superior mental visualization of how things are constructed. And so I just follow instructions and go along with him instead of trying to argue. So that's a good tip.
I'll keep that in mind. We bought the couch together fine. We were like, oh, we decided on it fine. So I'm hoping putting it together will go just as well, but we'll see.
I think there definitely needs to be a leader and a follower in the IKEA construction projects.
I wanted to chat with you today. You know, you were the writer of the first episode that aired of The Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. But where did your career in the arts begin?
Well, actually, it begins in Oakland when I was still a waitress at Mama's Royal Cafe, and I had been doing cartoons, amateur comics, for a long time anyway. And someone told me they had a friend who worked for the Berkeley Barb, and I should go see them, and I did. And the guy said, "Well, we already have Zippy the Pinhead, but there's always the Spectator." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's our other paper." And he points the guy at the next desk over. And it turns out the Spectator is the adult classified newspaper that was at that point keeping the now kind of failing Berkeley Barb, which had been a radical firebrand newspaper of the 60s. Now it was the late 70s and they were kind of floundering, and the Spectator, their adult classifieds weekly sister paper, was really what was keeping them afloat. And so they let me run a weekly cartoon in the pages of the Spectator for the princely sum of $12.50 a week.
Wow. I'm curious what the Bay Area was like back then. I've lived in Berkeley now for 11 years, and I love the place, but I moved here in like 2006. What was Berkeley and Oakland all that like back in the 70s and early 80s?
Well, it was kind of like the Wild West. It was cheap. It was cheap to get an apartment or a whole house. It was funky. It was, Rockridge was just starting to get gentrified at that point. Mm-hmm. But every place else was still pretty funky. But it was always beautiful. I just fell in love with it. When I moved there to go to art school, to California College of Arts and Crafts in 1975. And I just always thought it was so much better than San Francisco, because it was it was cheaper and it was warmer and it was friendlier and just full of all kinds of weird hidden possibilities and really a lot of really strange, quirky working class kind of working class commie eccentrics, iconoclast type people, but not like wild, hairy, hippie commies from like Berkeley. Oakland was more blue collar.
That's kind of still the feel I get today, though. It's definitely a lot more gentrified now, I am expecting.
Yeah. Anyway, it was, you know, it was like really fun. And I mean, it was like so much cheaper than San Francisco. I couldn't afford to live in San Francisco even then.
Mm-hmm.
So it really felt like there were kind of like endless possibilities. But it was also like the kind of place where people could and did like basically just fuck off for years. And mm-hmm. then like, you know, they woke up in middle aged and went, I don't own property and rents are going up and I don't have a career.
Well, yeah. So I was reading some of your new book that came out, your new comic, The Customer Is Always Wrong. And,
uh-huh.
and I get a lot of the feel of that in there, too, which is it's really interesting to see, you know, your character imagine the book is kind of struggling with what she wants her life to be while all her friends are kind of either dealing drugs or just kind of spinning in circles.
Right. Right. There was a lot of that, you know, and I think that's kind of tends to be the case in restaurant work to this day, because there's, you know, you wind up with a lot of cash in your hands at the end of a shift from tips, and the immature impulse is to, like, you know, let's go to the bar and like fritter away your day's wages by the end of the night, you know, and it's not a good model.
I know that book ends with Madge going off to New York City, but what ultimately, you know, brought you to L.A. and into the bigger entertainment industry?
Well, we were living in New York, and my husband, Wayne White, was working on Pee Wee's Playhouse as a production designer and as a puppeteer.
Mm.
And there were more job opportunities for him here in television at that point. I'd done my Simpsons script, and I'd done an episode of Pee Wee's Playhouse that I wrote with Lynn Stewart, Miss Yvonne, the most beautiful lady in Puppetland. And we both, you know, were thinking there would be more opportunities in show business and in television here. And we were living in New York, and basically we were at a point in about 1989 where we could afford like a one bedroom apartment in New York, but we couldn't afford a two bedroom apartment. And everything here was a lot cheaper and there were more opportunities. I'm from San Diego. We were thinking of starting a family, and, you know, neither one of us was really wanted to do that in New York City. And at that point, back in 1989, the thought of moving to Brooklyn was just too horrible to even contemplate. It was like, you know, like, it was like giving up. It was like you were moving to Idaho.
Wow. Well, I had a friend who just she and her girlfriend got priced out of the city, and they're like, well, we don't have enough money for San Francisco anymore. We have to move to New York. And then they're pretty happy in Brooklyn now, I think.
Well, my daughter just got priced out of Brooklyn into Queens.
Oh boy, man, that's rough. I was, as a kid, I was a big viewer of Pee Wee's Playhouse. Like, what was it like working on that show back then? And what brought you to that?
Well, we'd become friends with Lynn Stewart, and she had been working with Paul Rubens and John Paragon and George McGrath, who were writing most of the episodes. And she asked them if we could write an episode, and they said, sure. So this is the thing that ruined me for Hollywood, is that she and I wrote this episode, and they took our script and they shot it.
No,
which
problems
never
at
happens.
All.
Yeah. You know, that never happens ever. I mean, I just thought that was the way it worked. They took your script and they shot it, you know, and instead, in every other circumstance, in every other show known to man, they take your show and they completely disassemble it, and they add gags and they take stuff out and they totally change it around. And then if you're lucky, your name goes on it and you get residuals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it's just, it's very, you know, it's always much more of a group effort. But Pee Wee was operating as such an anomaly from the get-go that they could do anything they wanted.
Yeah, and I have to say, back then in the 80s, it was probably pretty unheard of to have two women as the credited writers on a script.
Yeah, we were probably, I mean, I'm not sure if Lynn wrote other episodes with any of the guys, but I think we were probably the only two women who wrote an episode together on Pee-wee. I've never really checked it out.
Mm. What brought you into The Simpsons, and how were you approached to write a script in the first season?
Well, my husband Wayne and I had, well, Wayne had worked with Gary Panter on doing the production design for Pee-wee's Playhouse. So we had become friends with Gary, and Gary introduced us to Matt Groening in L.A., and we became friends with Matt. And then, you know, like, this was like 87 or so, and like by, you know, 86, 87, I forget. Anyway, Matt was like calling all his cartoonist friends and asking them if, I could be wrong here, but it seemed like he was asking his friends if they wanted to write an episode of this new show he had going. And apparently I was the only one who didn't go, oh, poo-poo, I'm like so far beyond the constraints of commercial television. I went, yeah, sure. So, you know, I wrote an episode, and then I went in for one rewrite meeting. And then I was with Sam Simon and Mike Reese and Al Jean and Matt. And then that was all she wrote. And literally, I was not asked to be on staff. And, you know, I spent years thinking, gee, was I just not good enough? And then, like, finally through the grapevine, I learned that Sam Simon was going through a divorce and didn't want any women around. Meanwhile, nobody, including Matt, ever called me to explain to me what was going on. Mm. And, you know, nothing. And
that's terrible.
So, yeah, it was. And, you know, and I get to be the turd in the punch bowl every single time I tell this story, because nobody wants to hear anything bad about The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Sam Simon did a lot of really great things for animals. You know, in the world of Hollywood, he had a reputation of being not a very nice person.
I had heard that in other biographies of him as well. And I mean, that's just so, you know, as fans of the show, you want to think everything's perfect all the time. And so it's very disappointing to hear something
like that.
You know,
I'll tell you, male comedians and many male comedy writers are horrible, damaged people.
Mm.
They're really horrible, unpleasant, very competitive, nasty human beings. This is a fact.
So did that rewrite session, at least, did that go well in the moment?
It was interesting. It was kind of tense and weird, but I really felt like there was one thing I definitely learned a lot from sitting in that meeting. And the thing that stands out was that I had made up, like, there's that part about like Christmas of Many Lands, and I had just made up some stuff. and Sam said, no, you know, there's got to be something really weird that's real. And of course, back then there was no internet, so he was able to send some like naturally female lackey off to the Fox Library to look up Christmas traditions of many lands and bring them back. And indeed, there were things that were much better than what I had made up. And so the lesson there is, like, truth is always funnier than fiction in the long run.
Just to backtrack a little bit, I was also curious, like, what, now I know a lot of independent comic creators, thanks to, like, online and social media, you get to see them, know each other a lot better. But back then, what like, in the mid-80s, when you got to know Matt Groening, what was the independent comic scene like then?
Well, it's basically just a bunch of funny, nerdy guys. I mean, I have to say, male cartoonists were always much nicer to me than than any comedian or comedy writers ever were.
Mm.
And that goes for, Mike Reese and Al Jean, I had known them from The Lampoon. And, you know, they weren't very nice to me then. And they weren't very nice to me when I ran into them at The Simpsons either. And you know, the most of the male writers at the National Lampoon were kind of sexist, creepy guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like, you know, this whole Me Too thing. It's like, it's not even Me Too. It's just, this is the air we breathe. This is the attitude that men bring to us every single day. It's like that you're to be talked down to and condescended to, or you're a threat because you actually have something to offer that makes them think that you could be some kind of competition, so they have to do their best to crush that in every way.
I mean, this last year, I think, for a lot of people, has exposed them to stuff maybe they didn't want to know or understand about famous comedians or other, just, well, pretty much every man in the entertainment industry, I would say. Do you get the sense that it has improved some since you were there?
No, I mean, I know it's improved because there's people like Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and lots of really wonderful up-and-coming female comedians and writers and producers. So those voices can't be ignored anymore. So that's encouraging. And there's also a more of an awareness of like the fact that any movie you see is like all the parts for women up until really recently have been like, you know, the women are just there to be like the happy helpmeet or the sex object or the supportive female in the background who wants the man to succeed.
Yeah.
Or the evil bitch who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Or the evil wife of the character's best friend who says, stop doing this thing. I'm glad to hear at least it feels like it's improving a little. But with the script for that episode of The Simpsons, this episode wasn't intended to be the premiere of the show, right?
It was just an accident that it was the first episode because they were behind their schedule in cranking out episodes from, you know, getting the animation done. And it just happened that this one was ready and it was Christmas time. And so they ran it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know.
Yeah, I think
mean,
that's
you know,
the story.
I mean, and this is all I know because I've been out of the loop for how many years is it? I mean,
28 now, I think it's been since the episode aired.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, you know, no communication with me whatsoever.
Well,
so that's, I'm just telling you what I know, you know, because nobody, God forbid anyone would ever contact me to tell me anything or ask me anything about it from their end. I mean, I've been asked this question. I've told this story in interviews countless times, and no one on their end has ever been in touch with me to tell me anything or anything.
That's very disappointing as well to hear that. I was hoping I'd seen you mention this Sam Simon thing in previous interviews like this year, and I had hoped that maybe it had spurred like a new conversation on the topic. Or I do believe I saw that
they make too much money to care.
I mean, I thought perhaps that there was a recent hire of a big name.
Well, I don't think there were any
staff,
women on,
but yeah,
I don't think there were any women on staff there for like the first 5 years. After I think I wrote an episode and Nell Scovell wrote an episode and then there was like nothing.
Yeah, in season 6 Jennifer Crittenden was hired, but and she was the first on staff, but I believe even that was kind of a junior position when she was hired for it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. And honestly, I've never really been able to enjoy the show because it left a bad taste in my mouth, and I like King of the Hill better anyway. I think it's got more depth of characters. I mean, the characters have more depth and everyone has more depth. I think it's just more my kind of thing.
I understand.
I mean, it's less gag driven and more character driven.
Oh yeah, totally. It's much more, they're both funny shows, but definitely King of the Hill is more focused on like the people and also more down to earth, not as crazy. You then went on staff writing at Designing Women. Like did at least that Simpson script like open doors for you, or was that kind of,
you know, it really opened doors that then slammed shut right away. It was like an entree into both my husband and I, because we were both working the angle. I'd been done the Simpsons things and he'd done Pee Wee, and we pitched shows separately and together for like, oh, I want to say about 6 years, maybe 7 or 8 years off and on in Hollywood. And it was still like, this is the late 90s, mid to late 90s. So it's still very old school. It's very network driven. The cable hasn't really exploded. The internet is like just in its infancy, and nobody wants to hire unknowns to be showrunners.
Right.
You know, because there's a whole factory system of like, you have to have come up from the bottom and worked on a show for a while. And then maybe you got to, you know, be a showrunner on a show you didn't create that had been on for a while. And then, so it's still, that system still is in place with the way the networks work. And, you know, so people weren't taking any wild chances on unknown talent at that point. And so it was just like, you know, ramming our head against the wall over and over again for years. So we pitched till we were blue in the face. We pitched this one idea, and with this producer who took it to Nickelodeon, and like we had to rewrite it. And like, I remember like him calling me one afternoon, and my daughter was about 3, and it was like, you know, I was trying to make dinner, and he's like, this guy just loved the sound of his own voice. And, and he was like telling me that like they'd passed yet, you know, for like the 17th time. And he was just talking and talking and talking. And I just opened my mouth and I said, you know what? I'm sorry. I just can't listen to you anymore. And he went, Oh, well, okay then. All right. Well, goodbye. And that was kind of like the tail end.
I'm guessing he wasn't used to hearing something like that.
Yeah, it was just like, I don't know. And then happily, my husband was, you know, kind of miraculously found this midlife career as a fine artist, as a painter. And we were both able to kind of just turn our backs on Hollywood, and I wasn't getting any work. And at that point I was like, well, I might as well just finally begin on this story that has been nagging at me since I, you know, began working in this restaurant in Oakland in 1978. So no one else is paying me to do anything. So I should just get started on this. So that's how that happened.
Well, yeah. So is that what turned into Over Easy and The Customer's Always Wrong? Those are like, how long did you work on them? Because yeah, they are massive, massive books.
Yeah, well, because I was raising my kids, it was like between about 2000 and 2014 for Over Easy. And then I continued to work on Customer's Always Wrong. So up until like from 2000 to 2016.
You know, with all those ideas you had pitched, I mean, have you thought now with there being a lot more places to pitch things to, have you ever considered going back to that stuff?
I've been writing screenplays on and off for years with a friend of mine, and right now we're tinkering with one of our scripts to try to turn it into a series about a beauty school in New Zealand.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Do you see it as an animated show or as live action?
Right now, live action, but, you know, I'm open.
How has been the response to your autobiographical books as well?
Oh, it's been really great, actually. It's been very satisfying, you know, to have something like that that's, you know, this story that is like, this was like the story I had to tell before I died, and to be able to like actually get it out there was very, very gratifying. And then, you know, to have people respond to it in the way that I hope they would has really been wonderful.
No, that's great. And I mean, Drawn and Quarterly, they publish so many great works. It seems like a pretty good publisher too.
Oh yeah. They're wonderful.
Other than that, show you're working on, or like, are you working on more comics now? Or
yeah, I've been doing stuff for the New Yorker online. Mm-hmm. I've been contributing comics to thenewyorker.com since last fall. And so I've done how many now? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
Four, I think. Five. Well, five. They also did an excerpt from Customer's Always Wrong, which was nice of them.
Yeah, no, that's. I mean, I worked in the print media industry somewhat recently, and I've just been, the last decade has been seeing magazine after magazine and newspaper close. Like, has that affected your work as a cartoonist?
Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, I watched my career basically fall off a cliff. You know, in the late 90s. And I thought it was because I'd moved to LA, but then, you know, it wasn't. It was like people in New York have been hurting just as bad. Yeah, I mean, I had a real career in the 80s. You know, I worked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. And, you know, I moved to LA, and I was doing a regular monthly comic strip, full page comic strip for 17 magazine up until the mid 90s. Mm-hmm. And then they canceled that. And then magazines just started falling one after the other, and the work just completely dried up. And now nobody wants to pay for anything.
Nope, they really don't.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It's kind of a bummer ending.
But the New Yorker has a new young woman cartoon editor, which is really great news, and she's been publishing a lot of variety of. She's been publishing a lot of sequential comics on the NewYorker.com. And she also just got my friend Emily Flakes had a 2-page comic story in the New Yorker last week about her teenage love of a Bay Area punk band when she was in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah. I read that one. That was a great comic. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. So I think there's hope for for more sequential comics in the pages of the New Yorker coming up.
Oh, that's
I mean, I've always loved their single panel stuff, but single panel is not really quite my métier.
Mm-hmm.
So the American Bystander magazine is coming out, I think, quarterly, and is trying to be a humor magazine, an actual print magazine in the vein of the Lampoon, being done by some really great people, and they're getting all the old gang back together, you know. Like, seriously,
that's great.
A lot of people who young people and people who had been back in the Lampoon back in the day, and they've been great. Other than that, I don't know so much.
Now that you've kind of, I read you said, you know, Over Easy and Customer's Always Wrong are kind of like two parts of an opus. Like, now that you've told that story, do you see yourself doing another kind of long form autobiographical thing like that again?
I don't know about more. I mean, people want to see Madge, the main character, go off to New York and become a cartoonist and stuff. They think Madge goes off to New York and is partying with Madonna, and it's just not the way it happened, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out how that, if that, I don't think it would be nearly as dramatic a story, because I went to New York and met my husband and I was happy.
Uh-huh.
It's like, not as much. If anything, it would be less about my character and more about just New York in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, an interesting time to be there.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that sounds like a pretty interesting time.
Yeah, it was, but I don't know. I also have toyed with the two other pet obsessions of mine, one of which is Patty Hearst and the other, which is the Mitford sisters, but I haven't really gotten anything together yet.
A last question I'd have is, like, do you feel there's something, do you feel that the situation with you and the Simpsons could be made right, or what would you, or are you just happy to just leave it in the past?
God, I don't know. I never even considered that they would ever come back to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I've been sitting around going, oh, if only.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think it's really quite my thing at this point.
I understand. But all right. But thank you so much for your time, Mimi. And I learned a lot in this interview, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And again, I'd like to thank Mimi Pond so much for her time and what she wanted to talk with us about. I think this is really important stuff for Simpsons fans to listen to and engage with. And I really hope that you enjoy this interview as much as the other interviews we've done about the history of the show. This is the kind of stuff I'd like us to keep doing in the next year. And I just want to say that I think this year has been such a great year for Talking Simpsons. And I'm really glad to cap off our year of going independent with this great interview with Mimi Pond. And so I just, again, would love to thank her. And you should check out her work. Like she mentioned, she's been doing work on The New Yorker. She just put out her newest book with Drawn Quarterly, The Customer is Always Wrong. And there's tons more of her work out there. You can check it out online. I'll have some links in the description for this episode as well. So thanks for listening, and I hope you all enjoyed learning more about the life of Mimi Pond.
Lisa! They never let poor Rudolph join in the reindeer game.
Like strip poker!
I'm warning you, too!
Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say...
Take it, Homer!
Hey, Rudolph, get your nose over here so you can guide my sleigh today.
Oh, Homer!
Then all the reindeer loved him, and they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer!
Like a tail of a
little.